see that off, so it'll make me actually get him. We like
catch it,
like,
and then you flick it to him, and you go.
Good morning. I'd like to bring to order the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor for our November Legislative Day hearing. Thank you very much for being here at 8 a.m. on a Monday morning. We have informational meeting today with a variety of topics. The first one is about unemployment insurance benefits during a labor lockout. And to introduce this subject matter, I'm going to call up Representative Dan Rayfield and
Bobby Shuler.
So introduce yourself for the record, please. I'm not entirely sure we've met.
Yeah, I might be confusing some of you here as I have grown some facial hair. My name is Dan Rayfield, State Representative. Thank you. Yeah, good to see you again. From House District 16, encompassing Corvallis, Philomath. I'm here today. My district does not include Albany. However, I have a law office in Albany. I have family from Albany. And a lot of you may know that there is a lockout there, about 180 workers from the ATI plant. It's a very large news. It has a lot of impact in our local community. So we spent some time talking with those folks and started learning about the impact that it has on the community, the impact that it has on the safety of employees. And one of the things that we also found out is kind of their unemployment benefits. And so I did a lot of research into this, kind of trying to understand this process. And with Chair Holvey and talking over some of this, he felt it would be a good idea to kind of expose this committee to a lot of the stuff that I was able to learn over the last couple of months. And so today we have two panels. The first panel will kind of talk about lockouts in general. These are folks that want to work but are unable to. These are folks that are receiving unemployment benefits. And then we'll kind of dig a little bit deeper and kind of look at some of the impact from the instance that we have down in Linn County with 180 workers. And so that way we can at least be able to put a little bit of perspective. All these are lockouts that occur, you know, periodically throughout the state of Oregon, but this will kind of put a face to it so you can get a better understanding of what that looks like. The second panel is from the Employment Department, and they will kind of come up and talk about the nuts and bolts of employment unemployment benefits, how those work, how you become eligible for them, as well as how those are paid for, and kind of all the nuances that go along with that. Surely a stimulating conversation if you like that stuff as I did. I think you guys will find it very beneficial. Now, Senator Gelzer was unable to be here today. She's in a hearing, and so Bobby is here on Senator Gelzer's behalf, and they have a statement. So Bobby, I'll turn it over.
Thanks, Representative. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bobby Shuler. I'm from Albany, Oregon, and I work as Chief of Staff for Senator Sarah Gelzer. She wishes she could be here today, but she is currently chairing another committee, and she asked me to share these remarks with you. So this has been a difficult time in Albany for the steelworkers at ATI. 180 of these steelworkers are locked out of their workplace, and this means they're prepared every day to do their work, but they're not allowed to. Like 2,200 of their brothers and sisters across the country, they are locked out of their workplace. This is not a strike, it is a lockout. And it impacts the workers, their spouses, and the children and families that those steelworkers support. It impacts the people of Senate District 8 because the economic impact of the reduced buying power of so many of our neighbors is powerful. Unfortunately, these men and women have been turned away from work for 3 full months. They face growing economic hardship as they face the reality that both their unemployment and health insurance benefits are about to run out. In very real terms, this means that families must make a choice between paying their mortgage and buying groceries. It means parents facing the holidays unable to put presents under the Christmas tree for their kindergartners. It means skipped dental visits and mammograms and a heavy burden resting across the shoulders of some of the Mid-Valley's hardest and most skilled workers. Thank you for taking the time to learn about the circumstances our neighbors face while they are being turned away at the door of their workplace. When you go home to your district, please remember these steelworkers in Albany and that they stand ready to work. They want to work, and every day they hope it will be the day they can return to the vocation they love. They need and deserve our support. Thank you.
And Chair Holvey, we could answer questions, but I think a lot of those questions will be answered by the subsequent panels. So.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you bringing the issue forward as we have a segment in our law that deals with this for unemployment insurance, and it's important we know how it works. So thanks for bringing it forward. And I agree. I think others can testify and probably answer more specific questions. You're welcome to stay or go do some other business, whatever you prefer.
We'll stay here just in the event there are some questions for us.
Okay, great. Up next, Graham Traynor, Ronald Rogers, Josh Hall, and Steve Adams. Good morning and welcome. And the protocol is to introduce yourself before you speak for the record. Thanks.
Good morning, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name is Graham Traynor, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO, and thanks for the opportunity to address you this morning. The Oregon AFL-CIO, as many of you know, is the statewide federation of labor unions representing over 300,000 working Oregonians and is a voice for all workers in the legislative process. As you've heard from Representative Rayfield, we're clearly here this morning in part to discuss how a current lockout is affecting Oregon workers in a particular community. And thanks to Representative Rayfield for bringing these issues forward and before you today. I'm here to provide some context and a broad overview of lockouts in the workplace that happen during a labor dispute, how often they occur, how they are used by employers, and how long they usually last. Work stoppages that include both lockouts and strikes happen rarely. In the past decade, in fact, there have been fewer than two dozen work stoppages nationally per year. Lockouts occur even less frequently, with about six lockouts on record across the country in 2015. Of those lockouts in 2015, three have now ended and three continue with an average duration of approximately 6 months, and that doesn't take into account one extraordinary example of a lockout in Iowa. While lockouts do not happen very often, they can be devastating to families and communities in which they take place when they do happen, and you'll hear more about that in just a moment. Imagine having every intention of going to work but being unable to do so, losing out on the needed family-supporting income, and having only 6 months of modest unemployment insurance benefits to help ease the economic burden of your employer's decision to lock you out. Not to mention, as you'll hear about later, the challenges of being forced to decide on seeking employment elsewhere, often having to take a significant pay and benefit cut, and that's if you're able to find employment while in the middle of a labor dispute elsewhere. It's also worth noting the difference between lockouts and strikes. These two terms often get used synonymously, but are in fact very different and opposite in terms of the nature of the work stoppage. Strikes occur when a group of workers decide as a group to walk out off the job to gain concessions or terms from an employer. Lockouts, however, occur when an employer decides when employees will stop working, sometimes by physically barring them from their jobs. As many of you know, the Oregon legislature has grappled with the issue of locked out workers in the past and how to provide the most basic worker protections for those in this type of incredibly unfortunate situation. I believe the most recent example of that is in the 2007 legislature. Currently, Oregon is in the majority of states that do provide unemployment insurance benefits to locked out workers. But this is, as you know, a very modest and from the perspective of a worker, as you'll hear, an unwanted benefit who is willing and able to work at their family-supporting living wage job but kept from doing so by their employer. It's unfortunate to see any employer use this type of relatively rare tactic, especially when much of their desired leverage comes from pushing workers onto unemployment insurance, a public benefit, and then pushing the lockout duration beyond the worker's benefit eligibility, 6 months. 6 months in this case. And as you've heard, and you'll hear in more detail, we're nearing, we're beyond 3 months now with the current lockout. But when these do, when these situations do arise, the legislature has proven that it can make minor changes in statute that can have a major impact on working Oregonians facing an incredible set of challenges and the communities they live in. We appreciate you taking a look at these issues surrounding locked out workers and finding ways to ease the unfortunate burden that they face. Thank you for your time and attention to this issue, and I'll be here if any questions arise. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Ron Rogers. I've been a staff representative with the steelworkers for a little over 5 years. I service the ATI location in Albany, Oregon, as well as numerous other locations throughout Oregon and Washington. Prior to working for the USW, I worked as a millwright for about 15 years at the facility that is currently locked out. This current lockout is a nationwide lockout affecting 2,200 workers in six states. Over 99% of all contract negotiations end successfully without a labor dispute. Strikes and lockouts are very rare. However, when they occur, they are often well covered by the media, so they appear to be more common than they actually are. Strikes are always considered a last resort and occur when the membership votes on that an issue is important enough to take such action. As such, the affected employees have a choice. If the vote does not pass, the strike does not happen. Further, while it's not encouraged, every member has the option to ignore the strike and remain working. Again, they have a choice in the matter. In a lockout, the company does not allow any of the members to come to work. The worker has no choice in the matter. When an entire local union is locked out, no individual is allowed to continue working, even if they would be willing to cross a picket line. Lockouts are extremely rare. In my time with the USW, I've negotiated about 50 contracts, and until the recent ATA lockout, all were completed without any kind of labor dispute, much less a lockout. Lockouts are a hardball tactic that can be employed by an employer. By denying workers income, it makes it more likely they will accept major concessions from the employer. This is especially true the longer members are out of work. Even with the unemployment insurance benefits, many families struggle to make ends meet as the benefits are substantially less than the employee's former income. Once unemployment insurance benefits expire, the pressure will be much higher. The company continues to operate with out-of-state workers. They are housing in hotels in Salem. While we do not have the exact data, we have been told by some in management that the cost of the replacement workers is higher than the cost the company was paying to have the locked out workers perform the work. They are counting on the members accepting extreme cuts and that these cuts will pay for the added costs that they're paying in the short term and the long run. This tactic is also harmful to the community since the wages being earned are being spent elsewhere and not in the Albany area. It is important to note that the workers at the facility in Albany have worked collaboratively with the management over the past two contract negotiations and have previously taken concessions in health care benefits and cuts to pensions because they understand that as health care and other benefits rise, reasonable cuts are sometimes necessary. Unfortunately, now that there are 200 workers locked out who are willing to and able to continue working, these workers are faced with incredibly difficult decisions. Like you'll hear about in a moment, the clock is ticking for their modest unemployment benefits to run out. About 20% of them have already found other work and are therefore not collecting unemployment insurance benefits. But for the remaining workers, what happens after a lockout lasts longer than 6 months? When a worker in Oregon is willing and able to work but is kept from doing so by an employer, using extreme tactics and putting even more pressure on them by running out their unemployment benefits, we should as a state take modest steps to ease the economic burden that they will face. Thank you for your attention to the issue and allowing us to present.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Steve Adams. I am currently a locked out worker. As a locked out worker, I would like to give you a firsthand account of how employers can negatively affect lives of workers using these types of tactics. Some employers do the right thing by their workers and everyone thrives. But some employers are using lockouts in a way to reduce costs, deceptively leverage groups of large workers and to accept concessions and force families into life-altering situations. For me personally, going from a livable wage job to unemployment insurance was difficult. I could not imagine how devastating losing unemployment would be after my 6 months benefit period. 5 years ago, I went through a divorce and was recently remarried. I am ordered to provide financial and medical coverage as a part of that separation, which means I am currently the sole income source for both families. So try to imagine living with the stress every day of losing more than half your income, causing you to juggle which bills to pay on a weekly basis. Do you get your daughter's prescription or do you get a bag of groceries? Next, after 6 months of being locked out, you lose your unemployment insurance. Some employers even cut the health care benefits for workers during a lockout, like mine did. to put even further pressure on us as workers, now you have lost not only your health insurance, but your remaining source of income. If you don't think that's stressful enough, I have a son who has special needs. As that is what the companies are counting on, can they force you to give up everything, your house, your car, your quality of life, for their financial gain? And that's why this is important to consider what you can do as a legislator to ease the incredible difficult situation as a locked out worker like me. One that is ready and willing to work every day could be in once unemployment benefits run out. By considering some remedies to these types of situations through the unemployment insurance program, it would go a long way to giving someone like me a chance to find a new place of employment. If we have to make that tough choice, which is not easy because most employers don't want to hire you if you're in a labor dispute. In conclusion, it's everyone's goal to work hard for a living, give your heart and your soul to your employer, and eventually reach retirement with some dignity for the career you've given to your craft. But when employers are allowed to abuse the system for their own financial gain off the backs of their workers instead of the profits from their products, it's morally wrong. I hope that you will do everything you can, at least ease the pain and suffering to the workers who are ready, willing, and able to work, will face after their unemployment benefits run out. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Josh Hall, and I'd like to share my perspective in working with the nearly 200 members that are currently locked out as they struggle to provide for their families and meet the challenges that are going to come ahead of them. Steve's case is not an isolated incident. There's many like that. We have one member that by looking at him, you would never be able to tell. Very physically fit, eats healthy, exercises a lot, but he has type 2 diabetes. And he's always been able to maintain that until now. He said because of the stress that the lockout has put on him and the fact that he is trying to find work as a very specialized heavy manufacturing skill set that he has, his levels have been all over the place. So he's really struggling just in this aspect to maintain that good good health. The other thing that a lot of our members have been running into is just like Steve alluded, is they go to apply for a livable wage job, and even if they are qualified for it and everything, they have a hard time landing that job. What's happening is they go for the interview, and I'll give you a couple of examples. We had one member that went and applied at Oregon State University. She said the interview went great. She thought for sure she was going to get hired. At the end of the interview, she just wanted to be upfront and honest and said, you know, I am part of the locked out group. She said she could just see their whole demeanor change and said they were sorry to hear that. They gave her a call first thing in the morning and told her that they decided to go another direction. We had another member that applied for a supervisor job out in Jefferson. He said when he had turned in the resume, they were excited to get him there. They spent 2 hours in the interview process. He said at the end of it, they had one last question for him, and they asked him if he would go back when the labor dispute ended. He told him that was a tough question because he had 20 years vested there, and he was about 5 years away from retirement. So at that point, they told him that they were going to continue looking, and they would give him a call in a couple of weeks if they didn't find somebody else. So it's a really tough situation that the membership is in. You know, when you think about trying to find a livable wage job in less than 6 months, and then you couple that with the fact that employers are reluctant to hire you because they don't want to spend those energy and resources into training when they don't not sure how long the labor dispute will last or if you're going to return, it makes it very difficult. So that's why we hope that you guys will consider what you can do going forward, and just know that whatever you do, it could really help a lot of people in the future, especially at least knowing that at a minimum, you know, they'll have some extra unemployment if need be. So I thank you guys for your time and your consideration on this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. It sounds like a really an unfortunate position that your workers are in. You don't need to speculate, I assume, but I'm curious about why this is happening. I assume you have had a collective bargaining agreement or still have a collective bargaining agreement, and was that under negotiations? Were you asking for huge raises? Why was the company not renewing your contract, or why are they, you know, it doesn't sound like it was a wage issue particularly, because it sounds like they're paying the replacement workers are from out of state, a lot of them, and they're paying them similar wages.
Yes, sir. So the contract expired July 1st of this year. We were in negotiations. Those negotiations didn't go well. The company came out of the gate asking for some major concessions. I mean, the last two contracts, this location has actually taken concessions in healthcare, as alluded to earlier, as you know, trying to be a partnership and keeping costs down. I mean, we recognize that the company needs to be competitive. It's to our benefit for the company to be competitive. That's what keeps our jobs going. It's not a wage issue. It really is primarily a healthcare issue. It's all without going too deep into how negotiations went, but it's also an issue of wanting to not give pension benefits to new hires, what we call a two-tier system. They bring in new workers and take away benefits, and those benefits, you know, slowly go away as new workers come in. But you're correct, sir. It's not a wage issue whatsoever. We made more than one offer to continue working under the terms of the contract that had expired. We also made numerous requests for additional meetings after the last meeting that we had with the company. The company declined to do so. We don't have any hard evidence as far as a document that states it, but we've also heard from some managers from the facility that the leadership of the company believes that after the unemployment benefits expire, we will cave to their demands. And so they're, despite continued requests to meet and continue to discuss the issues, the company is just declining. Again, it's not an issue of wages. We openly stated from the beginning that we're happy to continue working under the terms of the contract that expired July 1st.
So you don't have any ongoing negotiations happening?
That's
now.
Correct.
Sam Doherty.
Okay, just a couple of questions. The contract that you're bargaining, is that a local contract, or is it for all of the 12 ATI plants?
There's portions of it that are for all 12 locations. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an interesting, we're in what's called a coterminous group, which what that means is there's 12 different contracts that expire at the same time. It doesn't necessarily mean they have the same terms. Mm-hmm. And so the terms can be, and are, frankly, different from contract to contract. There are some that cross over. And on the healthcare issue, because it is such a big issue and there are so many people involved, that's when we reference Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is where both ATI and the United Steel Workers are headquartered. So a lot of the talks actually took place in Pittsburgh. A lot of the talks took place locally on what we call local issues. But the healthcare piece is being dealt with in Pittsburgh. When I say that, they're not meeting in Pittsburgh either, but it's kind of something that we call is at the big table. And also retirement medical is being dealt with at the Pittsburgh level. But pretty much everything else is being dealt with locally.
And all 12 plants have been locked out?
That's correct, okay. Yes. A total of 2,200 workers.
Even though some of the issues might be different?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I was going to say something, but I'll keep my mouth shut.
I will tell you the primary issue at all locations is health care and reductions to pensions for new hires.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The out-of-state workers that are working right now, are they working under the old contract then? Is that...
No, sir. I honestly don't know exactly what the terms are. Like I said, we've just been told by some of the management that talks to us, frankly, that they're paying more and it's actually costing them more to get out, just being blunt, less product and less quality product. But no, they're not working under the old contract at all. They put out advertisements for workers around steel communities across the U.S., for people that had, looking for people that had some skill set, although the Albany facility has a lot of things that are unique and true to that facility. So it's, even if someone's got some steel mill experience, it doesn't mean they can just go in there and start operating that facility. They are operating to a certain degree. But we've, again, heard that the quality is not quite there. But as far as the exact terms, sir, I honestly don't know exactly what those are.
A follow-up question.
Sure.
Thank you. The offer that they made in the negotiations, was it substantially less than what the previous contract was? Is that why and was there a threat to strike, and that's why they had the lockout?
There was no threat to strike. Like I said, we offered to continue working under the terms of the expired contract. And yes, the terms were substantially less. There were jobs that they wanted to be able to cut, basically, and contract out to contractors. There was the two-tier system for new hires where they wouldn't receive a pension. The health care is extreme cuts. Our members understand that they need to pay some for health care, and like I said, the last two contracts, we've actually taken concessions in health care. But this, and I apologize, I don't remember the exact numbers you might, Josh, of, but it changed the out-of-family deductible before you get any benefits whatsoever for a family to, I believe, $7,000. Is that accurate? So you could pay up to $7,000 out of pocket before you got any coverage whatsoever from your health care. And that's what they're pushing. It's a major extreme cut. And the company advertises that it puts us in line with what the average American family pays for health care. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly accurate. But I can't imagine families being able to pay $7,000 before their coverage kicks in.
Thank you. Representative Doherty.
Okay, I have a question. Realizing that there's a one or two steel facilities in my area, and I know it's a very dangerous job, and you have to be highly trained and so on and so forth. And so my concern on something like this, when you've got, the people who have taken your jobs, they're not... what kind of workplace safety issues do you think that the plant's been handling? Because this is very highly dangerous. Like I can tell you, it's a highly dangerous job. But what's workplace safety been like? And since the other people have come in,
It's hard to tell exactly what has been going on with like the injury rates and recordables. We have noticed people coming out with like hands bandaged up and things of that nature, but we don't really know how many people are getting injured on the job, the replacement workers. The one thing that is probably most scary is just the operating of the VAR furnaces. Most of our operators have probably 25 years on the job. And they know that in and out, and one mishap on that, and all of a sudden you've got an arc through a pot with molten titanium into water and it creates a huge, you know, hydrogen explosion. So that's, you know, that's some of our biggest fears and things that we worry about is, you know, just making sure nobody gets killed in there or there's a place to come back to.
Okay, thank you.
We have seen, I don't know that we've actually kept a tally, but we have seen on several occasions ambulances coming in and out of the facility. Not quite exactly sure the reason for that. We don't get that information. To expand on what Josh said a little earlier, I don't recall what year it was. I'm thinking about 99. Some of you may remember we actually had a major explosion at that facility that basically destroyed the entire melt shop. And thank God nobody was seriously injured in that. Well, I can't say that. There are a couple of people that were injured, but nobody was killed or had any life-altering injuries that were permanent, which was a miracle in itself, frankly. It is, I mean, on a day-to-day basis, it is dangerous work with burns and cuts and scrapes and that kind of thing. And then if there is very high potential, if someone doesn't know what they're doing with one of those furnaces and some of the other operations, to cause severe injury.
Okay. Chair Holby.
Thank you.
Mr. Evans. This is more of a statement than a question, but as I understand the request, you are sharing information today to see what could be done in terms of unemployment benefits in cases like this where companies have decided to shut workers out. One of the things that I was concerned about when I did a visit, and I remain concerned about, and is also perhaps something we can look into as well, is that, as I understand it now, under current statute, OSHA doesn't have the ability to go in and search or look when a crew has been traded out. The standards for training that are maintained assume that the workforce continues. And when asked if OSHA could do a temporary visit because of a temporary change in personnel, that authority was not there, that there's regular scheduling for those types of things. And it seems to me that certain, perhaps not every workplace, but certain workplaces where you could literally blow up part of the town warrants some type of visit for hazmat control, for safety overall, in situations where the company has decided to not let the trained workers into the building. So just a thought.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These workers they have right now, are they union workers? Are they union workers from another state? Are they non-union? And then the company itself, if it goes for a certain period of time with these workers, and as these workers get more adept at their job, and they do start making money, is there a recourse that you have to come back to renegotiate, or can this company retain these workers and just go on like normal?
The workers are non-union workers.
Okay.
That are, again, just hired from various locations around the U.S. where they put in ads in the newspapers. There's actually a firm that the company uses that does all this for them, finds workers. I'll just say it bluntly. They're what we refer to as union busting firms. When there are labor disputes, whether it is a strike or a lockout, these firms, they provide security, provide the workforce. That's what they do. I mean, that's all they do 24/7. That's how they make their money. So no, they are not union workers. And in a lockout, they cannot, theoretically, they cannot permanently replace the workers. However, there's nothing that says they have to end the lockout either. So they're not permanent replacements. Even if they ran for, you know, 2 years, 3 years, if there was an end to the labor dispute, then our members would go back in the facility. Did that answer your question?
Pretty much.
Properly?
Yeah.
Okay. If I could, I'd just like to make one more statement. Josh kind of touched on it and made me think of it. Our average worker at the facility is probably close to 50 years old. There's been, at one time, that location employed close to 500 workers. This is in the late 90s, with, you know, cuts and cuts in the industry and kind of a drive in manufacturing to do more with less, lean manufacturing, 5S programs. I don't know if you've heard of these, but job combinations, we're down to about the 180 level. So that actually is another thing to consider. The difficulty of someone that's approaching 50 or maybe over 50 finding a job that replaces the one they had. And again, back to the point that Josh was making, if they do find new employment and then the opportunity arises for them to go back, it's very difficult if they're going to be honest with the new employer to say that they wouldn't, because they're so close to getting that pension where they can, you know, lock in their retirement and enjoy the rest of their life. So just wanted to impress it on you a little more.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments on this. It's troubling to try to figure out what the pathway is for your workers, especially. Given the situation that you're looking at the future and trying to think proactively about what can be done for your workers, are there, outside of unemployment insurance, are there other sorts of benefits that your workers are going to be turning to? And then I don't know if you have any knowledge about what kind of health care, I guess, demands as the workforce that just replaced your union, what kind of health care do they have available to them? Are they relying on the state for that health care at this point? Do you know?
Some may be. We have, through the Steelworkers International, we have insurance that's provided to the members. However, it's more of a emergency medical coverage than a true health insurance program. It does not cover prescriptions. It doesn't cover a lot of procedures that would be covered by normal insurance. Again, it's primarily emergency medical. So we will have members that we're assessing, frankly, to see how we can help and see what programs we can find from them that this health coverage to the steel workers won't cover their needs. Say if we have a member that has an ongoing, say, dialysis treatment, for example, or someone that may have cancer, anything that's not an acute injury, the coverage is quite minimal. People that have kids with cystic fibrosis, or in Steve's case, he was talking about the need for his child. Those needs won't be met by that medical coverage. So in those cases, we may find, if they can qualify, some of them will have to rely on coverage from the state, or, God forbid, no coverage at all, and the generosity of local hospitals.
Well, thank you. It's a grave situation you're facing, so I'm glad that Representative Rayfield brought it to our attention, and we'll definitely have a conversation about what some options may be.
Wonderful. Thank you very much
for your testimony.
Good luck.
Up next, I'd like David Gerstenfeld from the Employment Department. Good morning, and thank you for being here. I appreciate that. I guess I'm just sort of curious what do our unemployment insurance laws provide for these types of workers? How long? Are there any sorts of constraints around the potential benefits that these locked-out workers are able to get?
Thank you, and good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, David Gerstenfeld with the Oregon Employment Department. And I'll go over some of the kind of general provisions and a couple things that are specific to labor disputes. In general, the regular unemployment insurance rules apply to these workers, so that means that they would be eligible for up to 6 months, essentially 26 weeks worth of benefits. Once they've used up those 26 weeks, there would be no more unemployment insurance benefits available to those workers. The amount of benefits that they receive depends on their earnings. It changes a little bit from year to year based on a formula. Right now, the range is $133 per week up to a maximum of $567 per week. So In general, people can receive benefits when they are locked out. That's one of the first things we do when these workers file a claim, is see why they're unemployed. In a strike situation, they typically cannot receive benefits. In a lockout, they typically can. So what we're doing with these workers, they file claims. We examine the claim each week to see if they're meeting the regular benefits or the regular eligibility requirements. That means that they're able to work, so physically, mentally able to work, that they are actually out there trying to find a new job, and that they're available to accept a job if it's offered to them. So some of these people may receive some weeks of benefits. For instance, someone might receive 12 weeks worth of benefits, get a part-time job or a temporary job that ends, so they might not receive all 26 weeks of their benefits consecutively. But once they've used up 26 weeks worth of benefits, they would no longer have any unemployment insurance benefits available to them.
Is there any federal provisions that prevent extending that 26 weeks?
Chair Holby, there are not. We do work closely with the federal government, as I've mentioned to this committee before, to make sure we're consistent with federal law. And it is permissible to have a state extension of the 26 weeks. There are some restrictions, but in general, you can do that. Oregon has had some types of state extension programs in the past, so there are some restrictions on how you determine who's eligible for the extensions. But if you make the deciding factor be why people are not employed, such as because it's a lockout, then typically that is something that is permitted under federal law.
And just to follow up on that, what's the impact to the trust fund or the employer as far as their rates that they have to pay into the trust fund on the employees?
So, Chair Holby, with the regular benefits, the way that unemployment benefits work is we look at the experience of employers. So we compare the amount of benefits that their workers have received to their total payroll. And we look at that ratio. So employers that have a higher ratio of benefits paid compared to their payroll will tend to have higher tax rates. There is a maximum tax rate of 5.4%. So if an employer has reached the 5.4% tax rate, no matter how many benefits their employees receive, their tax rate would not be impacted. That's how it works with the regular benefits. In terms of extension programs, states do have some leeway to determine whether the extension benefits are charged to that experience rating or not. If they were to be charged to the experience rating, then it would have the same type of impact. We would just factor those benefits into the ratio, so it could conceivably raise employer tax rates. If they are not charged to the employer's experience rating, then it essentially becomes a cost that is shared across all tax-paying businesses in Oregon. The benefits come out of the trust fund. No one employer is kind of impacted on their individual tax rate. But when the trust fund balance drops enough, then all employers would tend to see an increase in their tax rates.
Representative Doherty.
Okay. So the employer, in this case ATI, they pay unemployment benefit up to 5.4 of payroll. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Holby, Representative Doherty, that's correct. It's a payroll tax. The minimum amount and the actual tax rate can vary, but the maximum for any employer is 5.4%.
Is there anything on unemployment if they find out that the employer was the one that caused, you know, by whatever reason, the unemployment and thing? Are you saying that you can actually raise their rates if they were actually the cause of the layoff and the collection of unemployment benefits?
Not directly. Generally, it's just looking at the ratio of benefits paid to payroll. There are some complications where sometimes employers can have benefits that were paid not be included in that computation.
But you said something about an extension, and then that would be charged to the employer?
Correct. Representative Doherty, and I was trying to respond to Chair Hovey's question about whether it's permissible for states to extend the 26 weeks of benefits.
Thank you.
So if a state were to do that, it would have the option of including those additional weeks of benefits. It would have the option of either charging those, including that in the formula to determine employer tax rates or not.
Okay. Thank you. That's the answer to the question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How common has it been in Oregon for employees to collect unemployment insurance under this lockout provision of the unemployment insurance laws?
Chair Holby, I don't have any solid data. I know in my tenure of about 4 years, this is the first one that I'm aware of, so it's not terribly frequent.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So the employer right now pays the unemployment insurance, and so if this goes the full 6 months, then that will go against their experience rating, regardless of who, you know, Representative Doherty mentioned, regardless of whose fault it was, it's still the employer that pays for that insurance, and then their experience rating will go up regardless. Is that correct?
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, largely. There are some exceptions when we look at why someone's unemployed. If someone is unemployed because they quit and it had nothing to do with the employer at all, the reason why the person quit, then the charges would not be factored into that experience rating. But in general, it tends to be that if the person receives benefits, the employer gets charged.
Thank you. But to be clear, the employer sends in the coupon with the amount for the unemployment trust benefits, but it is a payroll tax and comes out of the wage of the worker. Isn't that correct?
Chair Holby, it is an employer-paid tax, so they do send in the payment with the quarterly coupon to the employment department. It is not something that's deducted from the worker's wages. It's essentially an insurance program where the premium is being paid by the employer through a payroll tax.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Any other? Thank you for making yourself available this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next, we are changing our informational meeting to taking a look at Oregon's workforce system. And up first, Alana Pertle-Guinney and Lisa Neisenfeld. I guess we could bring up. Does you want to wait, or you all want to come up together? Okay. Karen Humblebaugh and Christina Payne. Good morning, and thank you so much for coming forward. I thought it would be good for our committee to learn something about our workforce and what's going on.
Thanks, and I am looking to see if our PowerPoint starts. Perfect.
You ask and you shall receive.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinney. I'm here on behalf of the governor's office. It's good to be back before you all. I am starting this off just giving you a little bit of an overview of Oregon's workforce system, focusing in on what we are trying to accomplish right now, what our main goals are, and some of the more recent changes within workforce policy and the programs within our workforce system in our state, so that you all have an up-to-date view of what that looks like for Oregonians. I should start out by saying that workforce is a little bit elusive to a lot of people because it's not located in a single agency or in a single policy area. We are operating right now under the broad idea that workforce is a connector, that it is that piece that can take us from education to economic development, that it is that piece that can take a worker from sitting on the sidelines to having a good high-wage job, that can take an employer from struggling to expand their business to having a solid workforce so that they can grow in our state. We are working at the moment to expand decision-making at the local level. I'll talk a little bit later, as will some of my colleagues up here, about what the workforce system looks like. But at a high level, there is a state workforce board, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which oversees a lot of workforce policy within the state. And then there are local boards, local workforce investment boards, which make the actual investments at the local level in upgrading worker skills and ensuring that employers have the workforce that they need locally. And we are trying right now to push a lot of the decision-making down to the local level where it can be tailored more specifically to the needs of workers and employers in that region. At the same time, and I'll talk a little bit more about this, we are upping the accountability at the state level to make sure that we know what's happening with those dollars. We're also working very hard to optimize resources. This is an area where there are every year more and more limited resources, and we're trying to make sure that we're leveraging those to the best of our ability and that we're also using the most effective and efficient means possible that will get us the long-term results that we need within this system so that we're using those resources to the best of their ability. And I think most importantly right now, we are trying to strengthen the alignment of all of the workforce resources within the state. I started by saying that workforce is an area of connection. We talk a lot in state government about the workforce system, and generally we're referring to just a narrow slice of the agencies that actually work within workforce, and not even talking at all about the organizations within the nonprofit and for-profit sectors that work within workforce as well. So it's a broad system, and we're trying to make sure that everybody is pointed in the same direction and moving in the same way so that we're not replicating and duplicating work. That's part of that optimization of all resources, and so that we're getting the results that we really need to for Oregonians. So the direction right now, we are emphasizing training, and that sounds to people who have been around the workforce system like a no-brainer, like that's what we've been doing all along. But if you look at the expenditure of resources in the past, we actually were not putting as much money into training as we should have been. So we are doubling down right now on making sure that as many dollars as possible are going into providing training for Oregonians so that they can increase their skills and ensure that they are getting the best possible job that they can in their community. We are also evaluating the effectiveness of the system. I mentioned that we are doubling down on our oversight role at the state level. That is in part to make sure that the programs that we are investing in are effective, both in providing the training that will help an Oregonian get a job, but also effective in providing training that will help them maintain a job over the long term. We don't want to be providing training that's going to get somebody a job for the short term and leave them in need of new training and more resources when that job disappears. We are increasing monitoring at the state level, and we're looking at what we can do to incentivize good behavior, to incentivize more efficient and effective programs. Because we're moving decision-making to the local level, we have to let go a little bit when it comes to making sure that programs are doing exactly what we would like to see at every given turn. And one of the ways that we can make sure we are still getting the results that we want is through some incentives and consequences. We have not tied funding in the past to results in the workforce system, but it is something that we're considering at this point moving forward. So I mentioned that the system is in many ways overseen by the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and I want to talk a little bit about what that board is doing, because as part of the changes within our workforce system, we're changing the role of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board to some extent. This is the board that has traditionally had oversight of the workforce system, although that's meant different things at different times, and that recommends workforce policy to the governor. In addition to that, we are now looking at what the Oregon Workforce Investment Board can do to hold system partners accountable for results. So when we say local decision making, we are not saying that without clear guidance from the state level, and we are not saying that without laying out clear metrics that need to be met at the state level. The Oregon Workforce Investment Board will be the board that makes sure that our local partners are meeting those metrics. They will also be the board that is providing feedback to agencies when those metrics aren't met, and that's providing feedback to the local boards about how they can better be meeting those goals. So we're setting up the Workforce Investment Board to play a critical role in making sure that we're meeting all of these goals laid out before you here today. I believe you have in front of you part of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board's new strategic plan. This was just developed over the summer, so it is a working document that is just being finalized right now. I do want to go over a couple of the goals that you'll see laid out in that plan. The first is that we are trying to make sure that the workforce system is easy to navigate. In the age of Craigslist, if you are an Oregonian trying to find a job, we need to make sure that we're providing you something that you actually can navigate with our state resources so that you come to the state, come to a WorkSource center to get help finding a job. We have incredible value added through our WorkSource centers, but we need to make sure that we're getting people in the door and keeping them there, and that means it needs to be a navigable system. Similarly, it needs to be navigable for employers. If we want employers to step up and come to the table and talk about hiring Oregonians first, we need to make sure that the system through which we're engaging them is accessible. Secondly, we need to make sure that we are coming up with the right solutions for employers. The workforce system has two groups that it's accountable to, as well as, of course, all of you, but it's accountable to both Oregonians looking for work and employers who might be able to offer jobs. And if we are not providing relevant training to workers, we're not going to keep employers walking through the door. Thirdly, we need to make sure that we are helping Oregonians build in-demand skills. If they're not getting skills that will help them find a job today, we're not doing our job correctly. And I would add to that that those need to be in-demand skills that will be in demand for the long term, because if we're not giving them skills today that help them not only find a job now, but also find a job a few years from now when they're back on the job market, then we aren't using our resources as effectively as possible. And finally, we have a goal to do more to reach young people. Your first job experience is incredibly meaningful in setting the course for your career. And for Oregonian youth who are well-connected, whose parents have broad networks, who have those resources to tap into, finding that first job can be an exciting experience. But for too many Oregonians, they don't have the resources within their own network to find that first job. And we need to make sure that we are providing opportunities for youth in Oregon to get employed so that they can then continue with their training, get a sense of what they want to be doing in the job market, and later become fully employed members of our state. So you should see those goals in the plan. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues within the Employment Department to talk about some of the specifics.
Thank you, and we're lucky and honored that the director, Lisa Neisenfeld, took the time to be here this morning, so thank you.
Pleasure. For the record, my name is Lisa Neisenfeld. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. I wanted to mention just briefly, we also have another council, the Oregon Talent Council. We're trying to refrain from calling it the OTC because we've confused our transportation colleagues. Mm-hmm. But the Talent Council was created in the last legislative session to add one more piece to this puzzle, and that's to look at professional occupations that are connected mostly with the higher ed system. So while the system we're talking about today mostly serves up through middle skill jobs, there is also a need to connect business and these higher skilled jobs, particularly when they are high wage, high demand, or when they're critical occupations that we need one or two metallurgists in order to enable a metals company to exist and to thrive. So that there are those critical key skills that we can't always recruit from other states. We would like to get those jobs to Oregonians whenever possible. So you'll be hearing more about the Oregon Talent Council as we go forward. They are working hard not only to put the funding out that the legislature provided to them, but also to connect those universities with better data about where the world of work is headed. And that's, I think, a big bonus that we had not quite anticipated. In the workforce system itself, the system that goes through middle skill jobs is principally, well, we find ourselves often talking about the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, lovingly known as WIOA, that has succeeded the Workforce Investment Act last July. It's federal funding. It's about $72 million per biennium in Oregon. It fluctuates with that inevitable federal trending down slightly. I think it went down 2% this year. We also, of course, have unemployment administration money and Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Funds, CDAF, in the mixture. We also have some state general funds in the system. They generally relate to very specific goals for the state. So there's about $10 million in the HEC budget that goes through Karen's unit, which she'll talk about briefly. They go to things, a program called Back to Work Oregon, which provides on-the-job training and other related kinds of training for very specific cases with Oregon employers, and also funds to help local boards prepare strategies to work with sectors of companies. If you work with companies one by one, we will never get there. We need to look at our high-demand sectors, and Christina is going to talk about that to give you some idea of what that looks like later in this presentation. In those general funds, there's about $10 million for CCWD and about $6 million for the Talent Council. So the state roles in workforce development, we're often asked about this because people are confused. I don't understand why. We have the Oregon Employment Department is responsible for businesses and employment services, so part of the WorkSource system. WorkSource is a joint effort between OED and the local workforce boards and their contractors. Mm-hmm. That's by design federally. The wisdom of Congress. I'll leave it at that. There's also the Unemployment Insurance Fund, which is a large part of OED, Trade Act funds, which come in to help pay for training for individuals whose layoff has been related to an international trade agreement. And, of course, our research department, which provides information to the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington, D.C., as well as considerable information for state operations in the workforce area. Then we have a joint division, and we're calling it the Workforce Investment Division. Karen Hummelbaugh heads it up. And technically, they're part of the HEC, but physically, they are located at OED, and Karen is a valued member of our executive team, and we work very closely together to try and make sure that all of our efforts in the community are going in an aligned and integrated manner. And she will talk about that in a few minutes. Of course, universities and community colleges play a huge role in workforce development. They provide the actual development of workforce development and are valued partners there. We're spending a lot of time this current biennium on trying to lift up and expand apprenticeship beyond the building trades so that we're seeing more apprenticeship. We have a federal grant in particular to look at advanced manufacturing, but we'll also be looking at healthcare and other occupations and working closely with Boley on that. The Department of Human Services has a substantial amount of workforce money. It is each of those programs listed actually has as much, if not more, money than the WIOA fund, so big chunks of money. I would like to say that we're perfectly aligned. We're not. There's a fair amount of overlap and some duplication, and we're working on that with DHS. The Commission for the Blind is another small state agency that is a player in this family. So the local service delivery system, we put out resources to the locals, and what you'll find is that local workforce boards are working with individuals through their contractors and through the WorkSource system principally, but not exclusively. You'll notice that we haven't talked a lot about that youth goal that Alana mentioned. There's a lot of build-out to do in that, but the local workforce boards do have youth funding. About 30% of their funding goes for youth, principally out-of-school youth. And as I mentioned earlier, the local boards also develop sector strategies. The delivery system for all of this is WorkSource, and they work with both employers and with job seekers. Community colleges, again, important part of the system. And then I call your attention all the way over on the right, local economic development organizations. I came to this job from an economic development organization. It has become clear in economic development that without a substantial partnership with workforce development, there isn't much economic development that can be done in this day and age. It's all about workforce, mostly all of the time. And those connections principally happen at the local level. So I'm going to let Christina talk about that more later as well.
Good morning, Representative Morning. Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Karen Hummelbaugh, and I am the Workforce Investment Division Director for both the Oregon Employment Department and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. As Lisa alluded to, I kind of work for both agencies, and I'm that connector between higher education and the workforce system. So we're going to, we were just talking about the local delivery system, but I do want to go back and talk a little bit about the local workforce development boards. We have the Oregon Workforce Investment Board at the state level, and then we have nine local workforce investment boards across the state. Those are led by private sector members, so they are business driven. They have to have a majority of folks who represent business and industry in their local area, as well as they're being chaired in their leadership from that direction. The local workforce development boards are required to have a strategic plan that sort of matches and works up into the state workforce plan. But it's definitely at the local level, the flavor of what happens in that community. There is the responsibility for those local boards to have the connection between what is the talent that is available in their community and the jobs that are available in their community. We're talking about some pretty small amounts of federal funding and a little bit of general fund that helps to support workforce in these communities. And so there are some choices that each of those local boards has to make in terms of where their focus is. So they need to invest their resources to align with what are the biggest needs in their community. We've talked a little bit about sectors, and I'll describe that a little bit more, but that's essentially the industry need. We are putting an emphasis, as Ilana talked about, into training. We've really done a lot, especially during the recession. We did a lot of, you know, job search and connecting people to jobs and some survival jobs even, but we really haven't focused on training in the way that we need to that matches up with where our demand is going to be in the future, where we're going to have job openings due to the openings for the baby boomers as they retire. And the local boards are actually looked at as the innovators in the system. They should be looking at what are the next great things that need to happen in their community in terms of supporting their businesses and connecting individuals to those jobs, making sure that we're trained up. There are a lot of pilots and partnerships that happen in each of those communities. And then the accountability mechanism is at the local board level as well. So evaluating how those programs are working, making sure that we're meeting our deliverables. And Christina will talk a little bit more about how that works in her local area. So this map is just to sort of demonstrate where our local workforce development boards are in this state. We recently made a change. We had seven local boards. There was one local board that was sort of a carryover from the past, which was pretty much all of the outlying rural communities on the central, east side, north, and south coast. And it was really really not representative of local communities or labor markets. And so there was a decision made to try and make a little bit smaller boards that represent better what happens in their communities. So now we have nine boards. As you can see, we've sort of separated out what happens on the east side of the state to the north coast, because as we talk about what are the business and industries in those local communities, it would be really difficult to say, you know, fisheries are important to the folks in Malheur County. And so this allows each of those communities to strategically plan and better align with what's happening in their community. And it also, you know, there are, you could argue with some of the boundaries a little bit, but we did have to have critical mass in the amount of counties because we didn't want any of these local boards to have such few resources that they were unable to operate. So let's talk a little bit about the role of higher education in the workforce system. Obviously, colleges and really primarily community colleges are very important to the workforce system, but we also have a variety of other education opportunities that work to skill up Oregonians, including on-the-job training, work experience, apprenticeship programs. All of these are part of that menu of services that happens at the local level in order to train folks up and get their skills. One important thing is that we really, the skills have to be relevant, they have to be transferable, and they have to be industry driven. And that means that we have to have a nimbleness in our education providers that is responsive to the industry needs. But also things like worker availability. You know, we can't offer all of our courses Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. You know, these are people who potentially are working a survival job or also working a full-time job and are trying to get themselves to that next level in their career path. And so we want them to be able to take those skills to the next job so that they can move along. There is a recognition that not all training has to end in a degree or credit necessarily. So there are all kinds of options in terms of credentialing and certifying skills that don't necessarily end up in a bachelor's degree, et cetera. So there are sort of smaller, chunkable trainings that really work for industry need in a different way than we've traditionally thought about higher education. And our community college partners have been fantastic in helping us to address those. So when we talk about targeted populations, the system really wants to be able to serve all Oregonians, sort of regardless of where they come from, and make sure that they all possess the skills and the abilities they need to be employed and to thrive in their work. And we have a particular emphasis at the governor's direction, but also the state board, on serving rural communities. There are a lot of rural communities that have been slower to get up to speed and their unemployment down at other parts of the state. They're slower to recover. Communities of color are sort of unrepresented in every area of the state, and also serving sort of generationally or chronically impoverished Oregonians. We have a partnership with our partners at Department of Human Services, particularly Vocational Rehabilitation, Commission for the Blind, and an ability to serve those folks as well. So each of the local boards is targeting special populations within their area that they will be having particular emphasis on, and that could be any one of those or a few of those, but that's where they'll sort of focus their energy as they select target populations and connect them into those industries that they've also targeted in their area. So the next slide is about industry sector strategies. We've all been talking about it. I know you've been on the edge of your seats waiting to hear a little bit more about that. But really, all an industry sector partner or sector strategy or partnership is it's a different way of looking at how do we engage job seekers and businesses and students and get everybody to the same table. It's really about being solution-oriented for those individuals versus being program-driven. It's not at our bureaucratic convenience that we do these. It's actually at the convenience of solutions for businesses and for job seekers. This is also different in that it's not an independent approach for, like, one business, or one individual worker. It's really about an interdependent relationship where industries come together collectively versus individually and talk about what are their needs across industries that can that are common that they can look at, and what are the solutions they can look at collectively. And obviously, this is highly responsive to industry demand, which means it needs to be a little more nimble than, you know, a traditional kind of pathway that we would talk about. It may sound like it's obvious and logical to have these kinds of strategies, but it's not really natural all the time for either the industry side of the house to come together and think this way, or for us on the program side to be able to deliver that way. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Christina, who will talk about the local, we'll switch so she can talk here. Sorry.
I can drive.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Christina Payne. I am the executive director with Lane Workforce Partnership. We're the local workforce board in Lane County. And I am here to talk to you about the much-awaited sector strategy work that we have done and that is being done across the state. We started, it's basically been a year to the day when we did our convening and training in this work, and I'll talk to you about what we've accomplished thus far. So when you see my slide, it says Better Together, and we've really taken that to heart in Lane County. When Alana mentioned the optimization of all resources, we realized that by ourselves, we were not going to be able to have the impact that we needed to have, but that we have a lot of different partners in our region that are doing this kind of work with businesses, but we weren't doing it really well together. So with that, I will say we've probably all heard some of these statements that I have up on this slide. You know, businesses are tired of all the groups coming to them and talking to them, and then nothing ever happens. We can't all talk to the same businesses, apparently. We really should be more coordinated, and my favorite is we are the ones who do this work. So I'll talk to you more about how it works out when you actually work together. So how did we get started? Whoops, did I go two slides too far? Okay, there's an echo in the room. So as I said, it's about inclusion and collaboration. So it counts, you know, all of these individuals, city leaders, chamber directors, workforce board, education, elected officials, economic development, business champions, and I'll talk about that a lot. Business as a champion and as part of sector strategies is really important to how these initiatives are effective and how they play out. And then industry groups. If there's an industry group that's a natural industry group for a business, they will much more naturally work with that industry group than all these other groups coming at them. So how did we get started? We identified all the stakeholders. So all of those industry leaders, local elected officials that were interested, Representative Lively participated with us. He has a background in economic development, and this was a big interest of his. And so city managers and chamber directors we brought together. And we all participated in a sector strategies training all together. This was something that the Office of Community Colleges at the time brought in some consultants into our state, and at first I thought, great, another training. I've done sector work since 2000, and if anyone could do a training, it would have been me. And so we brought in the facilitators and the trainers, and a big light bulb went on for me, because I realized in workforce development, all the sector work that I'd done previously, the only thing that I had focused on was workforce development. So when I asked a business what their issues were, and we'll talk about, as we dive into this, all the issues that businesses are facing, workforce development definitely is a top issue. If you have one employee, you might have a workforce development issue. Any more than that, and yes, all businesses have some workforce development issues. And so we would solely focus on those types of issues, and we did accomplish some great things focusing on those issues. We brought in training programs, and we expanded the nursing program in order to meet the need in Lane County. We did a lot of really great things, but there's more to the story. And so I realized we needed to come at it in a different way. We looked at the data. we, as a community, chose the tech industry to focus on. We had a business champion, Todd Edmond with Lunar Logic, stepped up and said, I want to be your business champion. I'll reach out to the other companies and bring them to the table. We had an industry group. We expanded the Technology Association of Oregon. They had a chapter in Portland. We expanded and brought in and hired someone through them that would be their champion as an industry leader. So I have a little cartoon here that really explains kind of how our history went, as it says, how can I learn about your company's needs if you keep interrupting me? And so this was kind of the tradition of going at it with what we had in our minds. It's basically what I told you. We would know that they had a workforce development issue, so there wasn't really a lot of other of give and take conversation. So how did we change that conversation? We brought the tech industry together and we asked them a broad question. We said, what does your business need to succeed? And we listened. So it wasn't about just, here's what we do. We're a workforce development organization and here's how we can help you. We just asked the big broad question. And before going on, I also need to explain the data, why we chose the tech industry. Here's what it means for us in Lane County. It's 400 tech companies with 5,000 jobs. They pay an average wage of $67,000. They're generating $350 million in wages annually. And they're projected to grow by 1,105 jobs with replacement jobs of 1,258. It's a big deal for Lane County. And if we just focus on the training needs and not on the businesses and not on what their holistic needs are, the businesses can leave us. Tech is something that can go anywhere. So did I just go backwards?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Monday.
I skipped back quite a bit. All right. So here's what we heard from the industry when we asked what did they need to be successful? So they wanted business-driven curriculum in local colleges. And quality of K-12 education was an issue for them. And I'll talk more about these and go back. Air travel, the safety of downtown Eugene, branding and marketing of Lane County, and increased internet speed in downtown. So if we go back to the business-driven curriculum, there wasn't a connection between the industry and the University of Oregon. You would think we're the hometown of the University of Oregon. But the University of Oregon was very insulated, and there wasn't that connection. As a result of this work, we have the professor of computer information systems on our Lane County sector strategy team at the table. They now host regular roundtables with the industry. And they are working in their curriculum the needs from the industry and what the businesses need. One of the big issues were you can collect all the data, you can build these big data warehouses, but if you don't know how to bring, like, assimilate that data and understand it, then it's just data. So the data programs that are going on and the analytics is something that the university is understanding and hearing and building the curriculum around. Improving quality of K-12 education. Well, this is a concern around the state, we know. And for businesses, when they're recruiting people, there's a concern about the schools or if they want to maintain a workforce. There is that concern around, is my child going to get an education that will lead to a high-paying job? And so there's been far more collaboration. The businesses are now at the table with the K-12 superintendents, and there is more conversation around the sustainability of the career tech programs that were funded in this last budget as well. Improving air travel options. The industry cried for an affordable flight or a flight from Eugene to San Jose. I'm happy to say we have a flight from Eugene to San Jose. And this was because the industry raised the issue once again. The conversation had been going on. It didn't just happen overnight. But because the industry, and in this manner, and having all the leaders around the table, because we all heard it, we all brought it back, we all focused on it, it raised awareness, and Alaska Airlines listened. And now we have a flight. And this is a big deal for CEOs of companies that need to get back and forth to San Jose. And we don't want Eugene to be the next San Jose, by the way. We want San Jose to stay in San Jose. We just want the companies to be in Eugene and the money to be circulating and coming back through Eugene. So I'll just say that. And then the branding and marketing of Lane County. Oh, the safety of downtown. This is an issue. I'll be meeting with the city of Eugene on Wednesday. The city of Eugene wanted to convene the tech industry. And when the city manager and their planning manager said, we've already convened the tech industry with the local workforce board. We're part of a sector work group. We don't have to convene them outside of this group. We know what the issues are. So I'm coming to meet with them on Wednesday to talk about the safety issues the industry needs, and they don't need to start at the beginning and wear the industry down. That's why this is so effective. They don't need to start again. They have the information and they can move forward on what the issues are. The branding and marketing of Lane County, the industry wants branding that says Eugene is where you want to have your business. We're not San Jose. Things like that, but maybe not say we're not San Jose out loud. But it is a place where they want that kind of branding so that we can bring people in and they understand that this is an intelligent workforce, that this is where they want tech businesses to be. And we actually, as a result of our collective work together and raising our voices all together, we ended up in Fast Company's top 10 emerging cities for tech in their July issue. That's in the nation. That's a big deal for Eugene. And then we also just recently in October ended up in the Portland Biz Journal for basically they wanted to know what in the world's going on in Eugene and their tech boom. So it's just an example of what happens when you work collectively and you work together. And then the internet, increased internet speed. We now have a pilot that's 25 buildings through our downtown in Eugene that have access to 1 gigabyte per second. That's 25,000 pages per second that it can be downloaded. For $100 a month. And this was our partners of eWeb, the Lane Council of Government, and the Technology Association of Oregon that came together as a result of our conversation with business and said, we can do this. We can have a pilot. We'll start it. And they're going to go further. There's more that's going to be done. This is going to expand out and will include Springfield at some point. So our hope is to have faster internet than what's even available in Portland. So watch out. So I was actually asked once, well, where are the workforce issues here? And I said, these are the workforce issues. We are still meeting with businesses and making sure that we understand the type of training that is needed. We're placing people in on-the-job training programs in these businesses to make sure that they have the skilled labor that they need. But we learned with other industries, especially in the downturn, we pumped a lot of money into a lot of different training. And if all of these other things, if all the other issues aren't being taken care of, and if they're not being heard, they can leave. They can go to Elkhart, Indiana. They might not stay in Eugene. And so we have to make all these issues workforce issues, and we need to work all together in making sure that business and job seekers are getting the skills that they need in order to work in high-wage, high-demand jobs. So what's great about this strategy, too, is that we can let the experts do what they do best. I did not have to get a flight to San Jose. I am not responsible for making sure that Eugene is a safe place, but I am carrying that message forward. And there are leaders in our community who are working on all of these strategies. There are people who know how to do these things that don't work for me, that don't have to work for me, but we work together. And I've been told by several leaders that they've been in meetings with people they've never worked with before. They're actually rolling up their sleeves and working on issues together. They like that there is some consistency in the message. They know what the issues are and that we're all working on them together. So, yes, we are all still meeting our organizational missions, but we're consistent with our message. We're more intelligent when we go to talk to businesses. We don't sit down in front of them and start from the first question and say, so, what's bothering you today? We know. You can go sit in front of a tech company and they should know. We understand that the safety of downtown is a problem for you. I have some ideas. Can I talk to you about them? Not, so, again, what are the problems? And didn't somebody else just come and ask me about those? Oh, well, that wasn't me. That was so-and-so. So this is, it is a much more intelligent way to work with people. And yes, we're just working with businesses more intelligently and collectively. So that's my presentation.
Thank you all for the presentation. I think it was a great overview, and I don't know that it's going to preclude us meeting in the future on these issues as well. But I'm curious about the sector strategies a little bit, and you know how the local workforce investment board looks at the data and picks an industry sector to strategize around. Is the idea that they pick the strategies that have the most potential for job creation, and do they usually try to focus on just one or two or three, or is it all of, and obviously the different locals have different strategies around that as well. Can you speak to that a little bit, what drives those decisions, how they make those decisions?
Chair Holvey, I think one of the things I was most impressed about in Christina's presentation is how different it is from other communities. And we are allowing communities latitude to pick industries and package industries in the ways that work best for them, because they're all very, very different. If you have 10 counties in Central Oregon, you're probably going to be looking at different sectors for each, the north, the central, and the south part of that region. So we've provided each region with voluminous amounts of data, but that data has to be ground-truthed with local industries. An example might be that the north coast region, which includes Columbia County all the way down through Benton County, it's kind of a little C, they may look at something they're calling value-added agriculture, or something broad enough that may include fisheries as well as food processing. So regions are creating what works for them. I would recommend to most regions that they don't try to do more than two at a time, because that they won't have enough staff to succeed. It will be kind of a half-baked. But that they start an industry, they get it going, they get sure footing, and then move on to another one. And so, but it will vary throughout the state about their capacity and their interests. Local boards will be the ones to determine the industry selected and what their approach is.
Thank you. Representative Evans.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. I have kind of a broad overstatement and then two questions. Number one, it sounds like you're doing tremendous work down Lane County. It sounds a lot like something that echoes from regional strategies years ago and what councils and governments have been trying to do around the state. So I'm glad that's moving forward. The first question is, what is being communicated to the HEC about certifications, and is it crystal clear to the HEC that community colleges should not, or there should be greater flexibility for community colleges not to have to go to completion per se, but rather employability for some of the programs. That's a huge issue that at least the community colleges I'm hearing, the HEC standards are getting in the way of, example, wine classes that they're actually at risk of losing some because there's not some formality at the end of it, even though it's providing workers. So that's one question. And the second question is more of a larger one to the advisor. I was a big fan of the CCWD before when it was a national model, and I understand things change. Do we have certainties that things are going to level out for a while, that there's not going to be yet another reorganization in the next 2 years?
Why don't you take the first question, Karen, and then I'll jump in. All right. Chair Holvey, Representative Evans. In terms of the connectivity with the HEC, that's sort of the role that I play in many ways to make sure that both the Commission and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board are understanding and connecting their different roles and how they come together. But also, probably about 2 years ago, we got together as the HEC Commission and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and we had a conversation specifically around the middle 40 of the 40-40-20 goals. And we talked about what that shared space looks like for each organization and how we support each other in that. In that middle 40, we know there are a variety of things that would count, that would be everything from a two-year degree or an apprenticeship to just a certification that is industry-driven to possibly just a class that is non-credit. And so we talked about where each system would work together in terms of that and defining what those things mean and where the handoffs would be. I think we still have some work to do on that. We had about 9 outcomes that we wanted to see that were collective, and we're working our way through those. And I think the other piece is that community college partners do sit on the local workforce boards, both as an education representative and then also the adult basic skills program in specific sits on those workforce boards. So they are at the table as members of the workforce boards, as well as being a large provider of the training services. I think for those of you who are familiar with the education system and community colleges in particular, the CCWD model that you've mentioned had a great model nationally about career pathways and how you move kind of chunkable different things in an industry that would get you to ultimately a degree program. And while Oregon led the way in those pathways, and we have many mature pathways programs, we're also looking at career pathways that might be newer and maybe chunkable in a different way than they have in the past.
So more specifically, are you getting the support inside the HEC for what you need to do? Because I know their main concern is trying to make sense of a new university structure. My question is, are you getting the support you need to make sure that the good stuff that was working is mixed with this new plan?
Right. Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, I think that is sort of the role I play, is to make sure that we have the support in both of the agencies. Both Ben Cannon and Lisa have been great supporters of this cross-agency division that we've created, so that we make sure that there is that connectivity. Obviously, at the HEC level, there are a number of issues as we've brought the agency together, particularly on the university and community college side. So I see that as my role to advocate for those things.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I understand Lisa needs to leave, and really appreciate you being here. So we're going to excuse you from further questions. I'm sure the three remaining people can answer those. Thank you very much for being here, though.
Thank you, Lisa.
Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, I want to make sure that I jump in and answer the second part of your question there, although I was hoping I'd be off the hook because Karen gave a pretty complete answer. We are having a continuing conversation between the HEC and the Employment Department around workforce development and in trying to create a more collaborative system, actually, between those two agencies and many others as well. When it comes specifically to the CCWD piece of that work and the community college standards, I think those two questions are actually pretty interrelated. We are building off of the good work that has been done. We are also trying to make sure that the skills that we are training in are transferable, and that the certificates we are giving are transferable, where those are not college degrees, that they are still recognized, which is important for sustainability of the work. I can't promise that there won't be any more big shakeups, but what we're trying to do is get the best results possible, so where there are changes, they are deliberate and well planned out, and hopefully don't catch anybody by surprise.
Thank you. I appreciate everything that has been done and that is going forward. I'm just nervous because I thought the plan before was working relatively well in some areas. So thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things on workforce development, and this doesn't seem to fall into really what was discussed here, because it seems like you were discussing workforce that wants to work. But over where we are, we have like a 7% unemployment rate. There's a large trailer manufacturer in LeGrand and then also one in Pendleton. And their biggest complaint is we can't find enough people to work or that want to work. And so the manufacturer there in LeGrand, when I was visiting with him, he said, they have about 400 employees right now. He said, I could hire another 100 people, he said, because we have the product to get out. He said, I just can't find the people that want to work. And so I'm wondering if there's, when we mentioned incentive or one of the other things, skills are the currency for the new economy, but there are jobs out there that don't require a lot of skill. They get trained on the job. But I think there's a lot of people that would rather live on unemployment or other entitlement programs that we have in the state, and it's almost an incentive not to work. And I'm wondering if we address that at all.
You know, the nature of the system is such that, I'm sorry, Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, the nature of the system is such that we can only work with people who walk through the door. But by having our unemployment insurance division and our workforce investment division within the same agency, and by having our WorkSource centers around the state that are specifically there to work with unemployed Oregonians to make sure that they are finding good job opportunities, we hope that we can reach as many people as possible.
Chime in, please.
Thank you, Chair Holby, Representative Barreto. I think this is where the redesign of the workforce boards could be of a great advantage to your region, where issues like this might not have really been on the workforce board's radar as much, and there wasn't that localized, concerted effort on what's happening in the region. So I am hopeful that this would be part of how the redesign and how a local board can focus in on the issues of the industry and raise awareness that there are good jobs, good paying jobs for people who want to work, and then focus in on efforts and initiatives for the ones who aren't as motivated, and what kinds of programs and services need to be involved and delivered in your region. I think the redesign should have an impact, a positive one.
Chair Holby and Representative Barreto, also, we're actually going to be out in the Eastern Oregon with first week in December, and we're going around the state with our Department of Human Services partners, particularly the self-sufficiency programs, TANF and SNAP, and talking about how we can do outreach to those two programs and the employment and training programs within those, so that we're getting those populations. You mentioned entitlement programs, so beyond UI, those particular folks engaged in what are the job opportunities in their communities, and the workforce board being able to talk about what those really are and how do we connect folks to those.
Great. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up a little bit of what Representative Barreto is saying. I read an article the other day that said that the average person with assistance in the state of Oregon makes $33,400 a year. That's $17.50 an hour. So that's probably some of the difficulties we're having. The other thing, in my area at least, is no one can pass a drug test. That's a fact. I mean, it's a serious problem. What are we doing with that? The third thing is, I believe I was on the original committee, subcommittee. I can't remember if you were or not, Paul, but myself and Representative Huffman, Senator Dimbrough, Representative Witt were on that original subcommittee. The big thing we talked about was the seamless transition between high school, community college, and the private sector. What have we done to accomplish that? We've expanded this thing out, I see that. But the original subject was, if you take these youngsters that are leaving high school, because in my schools, there is no shop. There is no blue-collar professions. But yet there are in the community college. But I can't. We don't seem to be able to get our high schools to cooperate with the community college, because Jiminy Christmas, they'd have to pay them half the money or something like that. I'm not sure what it's about, but we need to work on that transition and then have the private sector weigh in on it, because the private sector can provide the teaching skills, because they do it every day. And when we did that, I believe the two most demanding jobs in demand was nurses and welders at that time. I don't know what it is now, but that's what it was at the time. And you certainly can't go to school to become a welder. You can go to school and learn a little bit about the basics, but it's an art and it's something you have to work with all the time. Same with being a nurse. You know, you learn every day. But what have we done to get back to that basic? Because I didn't quite catch that we were really involved in that. The other thing that was disturbing here is, how can we get K through 12 to excel and be better? Well, God only knows how we can do that, because we seem to keep slipping every year we come out with the results. I mean, we're number one in graduation rates, and that's number one on the bottom now.
No,
we're not. And we're 43rd in results. So how do we do this?
Chair Holvey, Representative Esquivel, there are clearly a number of interrelated issues here. The goal of the workforce system, like the goal of many of our programs across the state, is to move Oregonians out of poverty by working with our businesses and working with Oregonians to make sure that we have the best trained workers for the job opportunities that are available, and that we know what businesses need so that we're providing the right type of training so that they can put people to work immediately. In doing that, we are working with the CTE and the STEM councils across the state. Our local boards in many areas partner with those STEM councils to try to do more to, as you said, make that movement seamless from high school through, whether it's a community college program or an apprenticeship or some other certificate program, into the workforce. And there are some great programs that our local workforce boards work with across the state, and I think a lot of this ties into the goal within the new workforce board strategic plan around youth, to try to move our youth into good job opportunities. At the last OWIB meeting, we actually heard a great presentation from some folks in Malheur County who are working on those two industries that you brought up, healthcare, nursing industries, and welding, to introduce students in high school to those programs, get them into the community college, and make them aware of the job opportunities in their communities that are available. I'd encourage you to talk to your colleagues who are on the Workforce Investment Board about that presentation, and I'm happy to get you more information about that program as well.
Follow up. But how do you get people to come off the system that is making $17.50 an hour? They can't work for anyone less than $17.50 an hour when the entrance level may be $12. How do you do that?
Chair Holvey, Representative Esquivel, I didn't read that article, so I didn't see those numbers, so I can't address
Hawaii,
it directly.
If I'm going to go on welfare, I'm going to Hawaii. It's $66,000 a year.
But the workforce system is just one piece of this puzzle. And as Karen mentioned, we're working closely with the Department of Human Services to make sure that job training is getting to folks who are currently reliant on services, and that we're doing all that we can to move people into good employment opportunities.
Thank you. Representative Doherty.
And not that I've ever disagreed with Representative Esquivel. We're always, you know, copacetic on that.
Right.
But what I've seen is, first of all, people want to work. There's just no doubt about it. They want to work. They want to get up every day. They want to provide for their families. They want to go through and be a role model for their kids, you know, and that kind of thing. But going back to the education part of it, there are a lot of programs in the state of Oregon that are dealing with exactly what Representative Esquivel was talking about. I happen to come out of it when I taught a school district that still has the Occupational Skills Center. And I used to have kids that would get out, and they would be welders, and they would be sheet metal people, and they'd be diesel diesel mechanics, and they'd be carpenters, and they'd be all of this. And they, in 2 years, they were making more than what their teachers were at that time. But that's still going. But there's also the partnership with unions, because we had a partnership with United, or with the plumbers and steam fitters in the Tigard Tualatin School District. And those were the ones at their training center in Tualatin were teaching the kids how to weld from the two high schools. And so that was also a good program. Of course, both parties ran out of money. But I mean, they provided the welding shoes and the mask thing and the gloves and all of that kind of thing. And for 2 years, trained kids to be welders because there was such a shortage of them. So it's not only the partnership with the community colleges, but also the partnerships with the trade unions. And then also the third thing is realize when No Child Left Behind came in, it was a big emphasis everybody had to go to college. That thing's been around for 15-plus years. And the school districts got rid of the machinery and stuff that they used to teach. So now to have the capital to bring all of that back is prohibitive. And so this is why they're partnering with the community colleges. I don't know about in the South, but up here, they're partnering with the community colleges and partnering with their labor unions to be able to go through and do that. Because that is a big part of the job industry that kids want to go into. They want to make something. They want to see something at the end, and so it's great programs. They are going around. So,
on this level too, the sad part about this thing is that less than 18% of the kids that enter high school graduate out of college. So that means that we're not helping 82%. And by being a blue collar worker, to me, is a very, very honorable profession. We have to quit downplaying that in our schools, because my kids would come home and say, you know, they said if we don't go to college, we'll never be worth anything. What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, you look at a plumber, and we have a joke in Southern Oregon, you want to hire a plumber or a neurosurgeon? Well, the answer is the neurosurgeon, because the availability is better and it costs less. And that's just about the truth, because plumbers make an exorbitant amount of money. Same with electricians, steam fitter, you know, the whole gamut of blue-collar workers needs to come back, because that's the backbone of this nation.
And that's what's happening. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening.
Yeah.
And it makes a good argument that we need to put more revenue into CTE programs, and I was on that subcommittee, workforce development, where we did start off with the career readiness certificate many years ago, and I know a lot of the local workforce investment boards are partnering with their community colleges and high schools for programs and internships for kids, and I think we're trying to go the right direction in that.
And the union training centers are state-of-the-art, absolute state-of-the-art facilities.
I think Lane Workforce Partnership is involved with a similar program with the trades, I believe. And there's several around the state, I believe.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, just to add, I actually took my board on a field trip right here to Salem to visit the new school that's the CTEC school. And it's amazing. If you ever have an opportunity to go there, it's something that I'd like to figure out how to replicate. It is a public-private partnership. It truly came from a private investor, but with public partnership from the schools in the area, the tools that they're able to work on, and the opportunity to, they can participate in a drug-free program that after a year, they can earn a certificate that indicates that they have been drug-free for an entire year. Because that is something that we also hear is an issue across the state, and there hasn't been a lot of emphasis on that. So the school's pretty amazing. If you get an opportunity, the welding that they're learning, they're building homes. They have a competition going on right now around the design of a work shed, and they're pretty gung-ho group of students, and they're pretty amazing. They're learning how to speak publicly as well, and the way they interacted with us while we were there was quite amazing.
Chair Holvey, if I could follow up just one brief second on that.
As long as it's a brief second.
It is. It's brief.
Time's up.
The thing that's different and really encouraging is that the CTEC school and Chemeketa Community College also build an applied science facility. and the trainings are aligned. Whereas 20 years ago, if you went through a shop class, you may or may not get the skills that are necessary for the field. Chemeketa and the local school district is working very hard to make sure those skills are aligned through the work that you are doing. So thank you again for what you were doing.
Yeah, it's a great direction and surely a lot of work yet to be done. Really appreciate you taking the time to be here this morning and giving us an overview of what's going on currently with our workforce system. I'm sure it will stimulate us in thinking about this, and hopefully what we do is also on the same page to keep this ball rolling forward. So thank you very much this morning.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Up next, we have a short presentation on an issue around injured workers and their right to seek medical services from the provider of their choice. And I want to start out with Vern Sabo and Chris Moore. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I appreciate you coming forward this morning. I know part of this was involved a bill that was up last session or on a similar issue that Andy Olson had brought forward, and I talked with him about this subject a little bit and decided to bring you forward and talk about the issue a little bit. We had a lot of legislation, a lot of work around workers' comp last session, but didn't get to this one, so thought we'd bring it back for a discussion. So,
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sabo, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. I'm a chiropractic physician in Albany, and I've treated injured workers for 34 years. Practice started by my father in 1956. The issue is the continued complaints that I receive and colleagues around the state receive of injured workers being forced by some employers to treat with a particular occupational medical clinic or a particular urgent care clinic locally, being told that they don't have a choice, and even being driven to the occupational medical clinic. In fact, I had an instance of another colleague in Albany where the safety individual drove the injured worker to the occupational medical clinic, went back purportedly, spoke with the doctor first, then the injured worker went back and had his consultation and presumably an examination. What this legislation would propose would be to require a conversation that the employer and health care providers have a conversation with the injured worker, simply telling them that, in fact, they can choose their health care provider, their employer cannot. And if mandatory drug testing is required, that after that testing is performed, then they can go to their family medical physician, chiropractic physician, naturopathic physician, whatever, but that they get to choose. That is the Oregon law. And this could be simply done utilizing a disclosure form. I've given you an example of how easy this could be using an existing form, Form 3283. Of course, you can't list a particular form in statute because they can change, and LC has told us that. But that it could utilize a form such as 3283, which does inform the injured worker of their treatment rights currently. Employers and health care providers are required to give this document to the injured workers, but of course those who are forcing their injured workers to a particular clinic aren't providing that form. So that's the proposal. Part and parcel to this, I serve on the Health Evidence Review Commission, the evidence-based guidelines and coverage guidance, reviewing the scientific evidence of what constitutes the best available care, best practices, and part of the issue is how injured workers are being treated. I'm getting reports from colleagues in the Portland area that they're waiting 1, 2, and 3 hours to be seen for a back or neck injury. When they go back, they're not seen by the same provider. It's someone different. Those types of situations, which is really a disservice to the injured workers. So what we're suggesting is that this is a conversation employers have with the injured worker, and healthcare providers do as well. They both sign off on the form that that conversation took place. We're not suggesting that an employer cannot say, you can go to the healthcare provider of your choice, you can go to your medical doc, your chiropractor, whatever. We've had good success with this clinic or this provider, whatever, but you get to choose. We're not saying they can't suggest or that to give their experience with a particular clinic. What we are hoping to solve is the issue of injured workers not being told their rights and being forced to treat with a particular provider. That can be my testimony if I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Let's go ahead and hear from the other testifier first.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Chris Moore. I'm an attorney with my primary office in Eugene. I've been representing injured workers for a little over 33 years now. I guess I'd like to start by just talking about the history of this particular law. In 2011, the Workers' Comp Division, Department of Consumer and Business Services, proposed some legislation that was ultimately passed by the 2011 legislature, and is now found at ORS 656.26021A. It makes it illegal for anyone other than a managed care organization to restrict an injured worker's choice of physicians or choice of type of physician. There's a $2,000 fine for doing it, but it's not being followed, in my experience. My experience is a little different down in Eugene than Dr. Sabo's. I don't see that aggressive a behavior by employers. What I do see, though, is that there is a particular occupational medicine clinic, and they have marketed themselves to employers and to other doctors. And the employers, it's not the top level of the employer, it's the immediate supervisor, it's the person that they're turning in the 801 to, that says, we want you to treat with this particular clinic. And they go there, and treatment, frankly, is not always that good, and leads to some other problems that I want to talk about for just a second. But, you know, before I do that, the doing this causes problems for the injured worker. The first problem is they're limited to three choices of attending physicians, and going to that clinic first without knowing that they don't have to burns one of those choices. Second problem is that because they have marketed themselves so effectively, they are literally overwhelmed with workers. They don't see them for very long. And we have some unfortunate failures of treatment. I represent a fellow who went in there with a ruptured biceps tendon, was misdiagnosed by the physician's assistant, sent off for physical therapy for 6 weeks, and then referred to the orthopedic surgeon who said, it's too late to reattach your ruptured biceps tendon. And that's the kind of thing that if they understood they had the right to go see their longtime primary care physician and get care from somebody that they trust, they're in a better situation. And it also, and you know, frankly, it backfires on the employer, I think. If they don't get quality care after being recommended to a particular clinic, they now distrust their employer, and that's not a good situation. You want them treating with someone to get well and get back to work as quickly as possible. And you know, that requires cooperation from the injured worker, and that requires trust in the physician providing the services. And when you take that away, you set up a dynamic where the worker is not going to get the best opportunity possible to get back to work. And I will also say, I want to be real clear about this. It is not an insurance company problem. My experience with my clients is when they have asked an adjuster, where should I, before they hire me, of course, where should I go for treatment? The adjuster says, I can't tell you. You have to make that choice. And I suspect that they are, it's a combination of two things. One, they understand what the law is, so they're not going to direct them to treatment. And two, they don't want to put themselves in the position of saying, I know what's best for you. And so, again, my experience is insurers don't do it, and that employers do more frequently than they should. And, you know, my belief, based on my experience, is it's really a lack of education. This is kind of an obscure part of Oregon law, and this proposal to have folks sign this would lead to some education. It's, I don't see it at the present. It's still kind of in its beginning phases. I don't see it as necessarily being a lot, costing a lot of money. I don't see significant expense to it because they're going to have to deal with the Form 801 anyway, and it's just a means of making sure everybody knows what the law does and doesn't allow. So,
thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this situation, I mean, a worker is never around this paperwork unless they're hurt. And usually if they're hurt, they end up in the emergency room if it's a substantial injury. And by the time they get back, they're probably not, don't really care about the paperwork at that point. They just sign off on it because I'm sure it's not being explained to them very well. This has been a problem ever since I've been in this business and labor. I think it's been 12 years now that we've talked about this. So I don't know what the answer is, but I do understand the situation because, you know, if someone gets a finger cut off or something of that nature, they're not really at that point. They've been to the emergency room and they just want to sign the paperwork and get it taken care of. So am I correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Esquivel, you know, it's hard for me to say. Most of the time, if it's something as severe as having an amputation, yeah, they're off to the, they're just carted
they
off.
They may have amputated on the job, is what
yeah,
I'm saying.
But they get carted off to the urgent care, and then they're referred usually to somebody who's going to, a specialist who's going to be able to deal with that before anything else happens. What the typical situation, I think, is you have a back sprain, you lift something, your back goes out, you report it to your supervisor. They say, here, you need to fill out your accident report. And so they have to describe in there what happened to them. And if they also at that point had to say, I acknowledge that my employer can't tell me where to treat, I think they would register with that because they've already had to describe the injury. They know they have to be careful about that because if they get it wrong, it's going to be used against them. And my belief is if both the employer and the employee sign something like that and have any kind of conversation about it, if the employer says, now we want you to go see our doctor, that's not going to happen.
So the issue being that this is already part of law, it's just that whether the law is being carried out, they're probably, and we're going to have the workers' comp division come up, but probably not a lot of complaints in this arena because workers may feel they could put their job in jeopardy by not following their employer's recommendation. Do you have seen complaints about that?
Chair Holvey, yes, and there's a, when people have ongoing relationships with a large employer, I just saw somebody last Friday working for Peace Health, and he was told, not by the HR person, not by the person in charge of workers' comp there, but by his immediate supervisor, that he needed to go to this particular occupational medicine clinic. He doesn't want to lose his job. He's well compensated, and you know he. And in that particular case, it cost him 3 days of, or it's going to cost him 3 days of time loss, which for him is a full work week. And you know, but he doesn't want to file a complaint against. He just want to tell the Workers' Comp Division about that Peace Health did that, nor does he want to go somewhere else initially. But the other thing I guess I would say is, you know, if they go there and they aren't treated well, that makes them more likely to hire someone like me. And, you know, I'm not sure employers really want that to happen.
Yeah, and for the committee, we, you know, I did outreach to the Department of Consumer and Business Services with the Worker Comp Ombudsman, and she provided us a little written statement that's in OLIS in our meeting materials as well, and recognizing that she does, she doesn't have statistics, but she says it's not uncommon for a worker to indicate that their employer told them they needed to treat with a specific provider. So just recognizing that the current requirement doesn't seem to be being communicated all the time. So I think this is an interesting, very small suggestion that we add a signature line to require the employer and the employee to both sign it, and that a copy of that be kept with the insurer in their file. Is that correct?
Yeah, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, but it's also to have a verbal conversation with that injured worker as opposed to say sign here.
Mm-hmm.
If you had just a minute, I'd like to go back to what Mr. Moore said about and this being educational. There's a lot of employers, I just don't think, know the law, and they've been marketed to by OCMED clinics and so forth. There's just nothing wrong with that. And I want to give you just one, my little story. Do we have time for one story?
Sure.
Well,
go ahead. One story.
One story. It won't be a long story, but this is a long time.
Figure we're getting off cheap because it's only one.
Okay. So, and I had treated this fellow for his sacroiliac joint, which would lock up, fixate. And if he didn't get right in, it almost always happened just before elk hunting. And he was scared to death that he wouldn't be able to go elk hunting. And usually when he'd get right in, one treatment would take care of it, unlock the sacroiliac joint, he'd be fine. If he waited a couple of days, he'd go into spasm, and he'd look much like the Tower of Pisa when he came in. And so one day he came in the door, and Tower of Pisa effect. And I said, so when did this happen? He says, about 6 weeks ago. I said, what do you mean 6 weeks ago? I said, we've had this conversation. He used to get right in. He says, yeah, but and then he told me this story that at work, he's a supervisor. He jumped over a conduit, twisted, felt his sacroiliac joint lock up, went to the HR person, said, well, you know, I've got to bug out for a little bit, go see Doc Sabo. And so, and she says, well, what happened? So, well, I jumped over this conduit, and she goes, well, that's a work comp injury. You've got to go to Samaritan Occupational Medical Clinic, which is the clinic in my town. He says, I do? She says, yeah, you do. And so he went there. He was put on opioid narcotics, Vicodin primarily, and lost 2 weeks of work just from the meds. Then was put into physical therapy. And he described doing this biped upper extremity rehab while he's sitting on his sacroiliac, which is killing him. He's beginning to get pain down the leg. An MRI is ordered because of the referred pain from the trigger points. And he went through about four weeks of physical therapy. Anyway, he comes into me to pay cash because he's been at the end of his rope, and he tells me this story. Now, he sincerely believes that HR person just didn't know. She just assumed this was company policy, or she assumed that's what had to be done. And so not only should the claim not have been accepted initially, but there was a lot of 2 weeks of time loss, and there was a lot of pain and suffering on an injured worker. It was not treated properly and should never have been accepted. So this would also be an educational opportunity as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Barton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Allow me to, Representative Kennemer can't be here today, so let me ask the question that we all know he would, which would be how this has done with vis-a-vis MLAC. Has it gone through that process and those discussions? Where, fill us in on that, please.
Chair Hovey, Representative Barton, members of the committee. Yes, last session we came forward with this exact, almost exact proposal of a disclosure statement. It was actually Ombudsman who suggested that both forms go to the insurer. So if there's an alleged complaint by a worker that they were told they had to go there, they didn't get this information, The workers' comp division simply calls up the injured, the insurance, says produce the form. If they can produce the form with the worker's signature, then there's very little merit to the complaint. If they can't, then there would be. It had one hearing. It was indicated that the labor side wanted to hear more, and then it just never came back up again. I asked what had happened, and it. I think there was too much other political noise.
Thank you. I'm sure you weren't referring to this committee's endeavors and workers' comp as noise, but
No, Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for kind of giving us an overview of this issue. I really appreciate it. And I wanted to bring up John Schultz real briefly, just because I can.
John Schultz.
And we understand that you could be retiring, and so we have a pretty long list of questions for you.
Yes, it'll take 8 months.
And given that you know, we do have a comment from the ombudsman, back to Representative Barton's question, this issue has been around for a while, and though it currently is practice that's prohibited, was there, you know, how is that conversation at IMLAC going around this issue as far as requiring signatures on this already required form?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. The concept was reviewed in quite a bit of detail in 2011. In one form or another, it's been around for several sessions. During last session, I think the Management Labor Advisory Committee was focused so much on the attorney fee bill that this one didn't get perhaps the attention. It never came up for a vote in the committee. In previous sessions, most specifically 2011, the committee did vote not to support the bill at that time. It was similar but a little bit different at that time. And the reasons were at that time that making a worker sign an additional form about choice of provider was going to add some paperwork. It was felt it was somewhat redundant and might not add value. And that, I think, was based partly on the department at that time getting relatively few complaints from workers about the direction of care. I think we testified at that time that we averaged about 14 complaints per year over the last 5 years at that point in time. We had issued 3 penalties and some warning letters, and primarily we're doing education with employers, because I would agree most of the employers where we have found that it's likely to have occurred that there was direction really didn't realize that they were doing anything wrong. We did follow up, just so the committee knows, in 2011 we issued industry-wide notice to over 90,000 employers reminding them, or at least bringing it to their attention, to provide the workers the 3283 form. And that is the worker's right to choose their own provider. The 3283 form outlines, briefly outlines a few issues that about workers' rights. It is required to be provided at the time the Form 801 is filed, and that's the filing of a workers' compensation claim, as well as a Form 827, which is where the claim is filed by the health care provider. I would add that this issue has been around. There's been a lot of discussion. We've tried to do what we can to educate employers. We wouldn't disagree that there are employers who attempt to direct workers out there. We know that that can happen. When it comes to an investigation, in terms of whether or not that's easy to prove, it often is not. And we do have workers who make a complaint and then under when it's under investigation, tell a different story to us and decide, no, they really weren't being directed as well. So both of those things occur. And I'd just be happy to answer any question I can on this.
Thank you. And I do remember these conversations in the past and, you know that we have tried to address it, you know, with that form. But it occurs to me this is 2015 and, you know, getting, you know, confirmation from attorneys, from the ombudsman that this is not an uncommon problem still sort of tells me that the workers are really not in a great position to make these complaints for, you know, fear of losing their job, perhaps, or some other sort of retribution. So it doesn't seem like it would be something that would readily be described in terms of how many complaints that you've or enforcement actions you've actually taken. So just in terms of that, do you see this being a very large burden of requiring a signature just so that it can be acknowledged by the employee and the employer that that is the law?
Mr. Chair, first, I would agree with you. If a worker is afraid to make a complaint, then, of course, we're not going to get the complaint. Secondly, in terms of a burden, putting a signature on the bottom of a form by the worker and the employer is probably not a large burden. There is a lot of paperwork that's already provided. Whether or not that's always going to be complied with, I'm not sure. I think Representative Esquivel is correct that a worker, when they're filing a claim, is getting a lot of paperwork. Mm-hmm. So there'd be some education that would need to be provided by insurers and the department as well, I think, to make that work. But that's something that occurs now on the 801 forms, that there's signatures from both the employers and the worker. It's something that can be done. I'm sure you would hear from employers more specifically as to whether or not they would think that would be an additional burden for them. In the past, we've held rule hearings on this that were well attended. There was quite a bit of testimony at those rule hearings about burden.
So this form is already required, though. It just is not required to have signatures. Is that correct?
That's correct. The form is already required. The notice is already provided on this form as well as in other ways. But there's no signature required at this time on this form.
Great. Questions?
Representative Cameron's done.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Appreciate that. I appreciate you coming forward. If we move forward with this conversation, we'll certainly have a broader array of comments on its proposed if it does in fact turn into legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's been my honor to work with this committee over the years. Thank you.
Yes, and we really want to thank you for your service, to this committee and to the legislature and to workers and employers alike. You've certainly had a great tenure at the Workers' Comp Division and have always tried to provide factual and concise testimony to this committee that in committees I've been on anyway. So good luck and enjoy your next endeavors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members. Thank you.
That concludes the informational meeting portion, though we do have one little more segment that I don't think really snuck onto our... Oh, it is on the back page, so not to be overlooked. I wanted just a few moments... to describe to the committee some of our interim work group and sort of the status and what we've been doing on these work groups. And some of you have attended some of them and some of you have not. But we have had four official work groups from this committee. We did look at the unemployment insurance benefits for certain school employees. We have a work group on brewery and brew brew pub licensing. We had a work group on minimum wage and also one on hydrographers. And so I'm going to turn to Jan just and put the burden on her to kind of tell us the status of where we're at as she understands it.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the first one, the unemployment insurance benefits. So that group met once, and in fact, we were going to have it on the agenda again today, but we are waiting for the Oregon Employment Department to have a conversation with the U.S. Department of Labor about the ability to allow classified school employees who terminate for good cause to be able to continue to receive their unemployment insurance benefits during the summer. Currently, they're prohibited. They would receive unemployment insurance benefits all the way up till June. Then they would stop. If they're still unemployed, they would resume back in September when the school year starts. And so the bill is very similar to what the committee saw, the concept is very similar to what the committee saw, Senate Bill 470. But before we bring it back, we wanted confirmation from the Department of Labor that it would be approved. So we're waiting for that. The brewery met once. Stakeholders from brewers and brew pubs, distributors, and they are meeting again this Thursday at 3 o'clock. So if you wanted to join the work group, let Chair Holby know. Minimum wage met four times. It was a very large group of stakeholders, 40 to 50 people. And there was never the intention that the work group would come out with a concept. Senator Dembro is holding a lengthy hearing on minimum wage this afternoon at 2 o'clock if you are interested. And the fourth one was the hydrographers. That issue was raised when the committee had a bill from Osbiel's, the licensing board for engineers and land surveyors. And the committee took testimony from some hydrographers who were concerned that they are not regulated by Osbiel's, and they would like to see some form of regulation. And so they've approached Chair Holby to work with Osbiel's. So there's one meeting, and currently there'll be some follow-up discussions with NOAA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, because they hire many hydrographers, and they determine what makes a competent hydrographer. And that is kind of the big question, is if you're going to register hydrographers, how do you determine if they are competent? Because there's currently no existing exam that hydrographers would take to see if they are competent to be licensed by the state.
Yes, and that is a pretty good overview. I will add that part of the issue with the hydrographers is whether or not they need to be licensed as a land surveyor, and I think Ms. Nordlund sort of pointed out that they don't really have a examination or any standards for hydrography at this point. And so this is an ongoing issue. Will probably not be a bill for 2016, recognizing that the hydrographers and the land surveyors and engineers are working together, and also at the national level, this is something that is being questioned in several places across the nation to see if we can align with standards on a more national level. So that probably won't be a bill. The minimum wage, I can't comment on whether there will be legislation at this point around minimum wage. The brewery licensing, I think we will have legislation in February on this particular work group. We haven't quite come to agreement, but we have quite a bit of overlapping agreement on some of the issues, so I'm hopeful we'll have some legislation on that. And the unemployment insurance benefits for certain school employees is at yet a little bit up in the air whether we'll be addressing that through legislation. I have a meeting set with Senator Dembro, my Senate counterpart, to kind of go over some of these issues and some of the other issues he's working on. To see if we have the ability to coordinate what we're bringing forward. So that's sort of the status of our work groups, and I appreciate Representative Kinnemer has been at a lot of the brewery and brew pub. Representative Barreto has been at a few of the work groups as well. So we have had some good conversations. Representative Burton.
Question I can't believe I'm asking, because I've gone my whole life perfectly well without thinking about the mortuary regulation. But I recall at the end of session, remember there was a series of bills from the board. Some of them got worked out, and I've noticed a flurry of rulemaking lately from the mortuary board. I'm assuming they are connected. Is that largely petered out, or are we going to, in the short session, have more mortuary bills, which I'm sure Representative Kenner would love to work on?
It's my understanding that most of that rulemaking is associated with the bills that we have passed, and I have not heard that they're seeking any
perfect.
More.
Good.
Not dead.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes. It's certainly in stasis.
Couldn't help it.
So, but I haven't had any direct contact with the mortuary board this week.
I'm not going to jinx it. Really.
If you want to outreach to him, you're certainly welcome.
Did you save a prairie bar?
So, as well, I just want to make an announcement. As many of you know, Charlie Cheek from Legislative Council passed away recently. A really, tragic thing to have that happen right as he's retiring. And I just wanted to comment about what a great drafter he was, a great person in Legislative Council, working on a lot of issues that were before this committee, the workers' comp, the paid sick leave, and I just loved working with him. He was really attentive to trying to get it right, making sure it was clear, he really did a great job for this legislature and the state of Oregon, and just wanted to comment about his passing and about how much we'll miss him, and I'm sure his shoes will be very difficult to fill. So with that, Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, Charlie was a gentleman, an extremely well-educated gentleman. And he's quite a loss to us. He'd retired, and I've seen this happen on numerous occasions where someone will get ready to retire, and when they retire, then they have a problem. And they don't really get to retire, and it's such a shame, because Charlie certainly, if anyone deserved it, he did.
Yes, he was definitely a hard worker, and we put him through a lot of amendments.
You did, I didn't. I was his friend.
Yeah, very good outlook. So, Charlie, if you're listening,
Charlie,
thank you.
He was my friend. He came up and visited me.
So with that, I will adjourn the House Nice Committee on Business and Labor. I hope you have a great week. Business and Labor. I hope you have a great week.